Here at Accepted, we're getting more and more inquiries from applicants interested in PhD programs in the STEM fields. And we have a panel of experts on today's show to discuss PhD admissions in engineering, life sciences, and, well, STEM. If that's something you are considering, not to mention aiming for, this is the episode for you.
Welcome to Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. Your host is Accepted's founder and world-renowned admissions guru, Linda Abraham. At Accepted, our mission is to get you to that unforgettable moment when you read your acceptance email and shout, "Yes, I'm in!" Confident you'll be attending the perfect program to help you launch the career of your dreams.
Welcome to the 566th episode of Admission Straight Talk. Thanks for tuning in. The challenge at the heart of PhD admissions is showing that you both fit in at your target programs and stand out in the applicant pool. Except its free download, Fitting In and Standing Out, The Paradox at the Heart of Admissions, will show you how to do both. Master this paradox and you are well on your way to acceptance. You can download this free guide at accepted.com/FISO, as in fitting in and standing out. Again, that URL is accepted.com/FISO. Our panelists today are Dr. Karen Ash, Accepted consultant since 2015 and former director of the Career Management Center at Cornell's Johnson School, career coach at Cornell's College of Engineering, and director of Cornell University's Career Services. Dr. Herman Flash Gordon, Accepted consultant since 2014 and former chair of the University of Arizona Tucson College of Medicine's Admissions Committee, as well as a member of several PhD admissions committees. And Dr. Barry Rothman, Accepted consultant since 2015 and emeritus professor of biology and founder and former director of San Francisco State University's post-bac programs. Now, you're all repeat guests, so welcome back to Admission Straight Talk.
Great to be here.
I'm delighted you can all join me. The first thing I'd like to start with is just that I realize when we talk about PhDs in STEM, we have a very broad topic. So what will most STEM PhD programs want to see in applicants, both academically and experientially? And Karen, why don't you start?
You know, I used to work with MBAs. Mm-hmm. When I was at one of my stints at Cornell, was working with MBAs, and the admissions team would look for leadership and achievements in that regard, personality, being able to lead a team, being able to get along with a lot of other people and be able to motivate other people. I have found with STEM that it is very, very much about achievements in the STEM field and less focus on personality. Yes, you need to get along on any project team. And yes, it would be ideal that if you are, let's say, going to work in industry, that you become a leader someday. But I think what I have seen is it's more about the achievements in their field. And some of my PhD clients have come directly from undergrad. They were just able to get a number of research experiences as an undergrad and applied successfully to PhD programs. Others have come to me from master's programs. And I'm not sure that there is a right way or a wrong way. It depends on what your own experience is. But you can be successful either route.
You seem to be dealing more with the experiential qualifications.
Especially research experience.
Research, right.
You know, if you only, let's say you're applying after working in industry, but you never had any research experience as an undergrad or in industry, then the challenge is much tougher. If you had research experiences at your university, even if you're not published, you have an easier path.
Okay. Barry, you look like you want to add
something. Yeah, I wanted to add that I think for STEM PhD applicants, one of the criteria is you need to know how to think, and that the entire application process emphasizes that and experience. They don't want somebody who was a pair of hands, who was told what to do on a research project and wasn't intellectually involved. So I think that's extremely important. And then I think this is advice I give to all my PhD interviewees is be a good listener. A lot of times when you're being interviewed, the person interviewing you wants to tell you more about them than they want to know about you. So being a good listener really, really works. And one of my mentees with whom I work, who's not an accepted client, just got into UCSF's PhD program. So, and I told him to be a good listener and it worked very well.
All right. Flash, do you want to add anything to this?
I think there's this issue of metrics versus experiences. And there was a sea change in STEM about 10 years ago or so, where metrics really got downplayed.
Metrics meaning GPA and test score?
Exactly. So a lot of places don't even accept GRE scores anymore. And what they want instead is a strong letter from your PhD advisor and good experience.
You know, the PhD advisor you're going to have after you get accepted.
Oh, sorry. Right. Your undergraduate PI. Right.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. And so they want evidence that you can problem solve, that you can make an experiment work. You know, it's people talk about having good hands, right? And if you have good hands, it means, yeah, you get results. And there are a lot of people who can't do that. And it won't show up in their metrics. But it does show up in what you write about in your personal statement and what your advisor writes about your performance. So that's what's most important. Right. There was actually a formal study about this where they looked at outcomes for PhD students. It was actually in biological sciences, so biochemistry. And what they found was that the metrics had absolutely no correlation with outcomes. Mm. And that what did have a very strong outcome was the letter from the undergraduate PI.
I would add one more thing. Barry, you emphasized thinking, and Flash mentioned problem solving. Depending on the field, but I'm thinking of computer science and, you know, some of the sciences, being innovative and creative is also important. Mm-hmm. Because depending on what you're going to do, you know, first of all, your research is going to be original. But if you're going into any kind of industry position, you're going to be developing products. You need to be innovative. You need to be a visionary.
Isn't part of the purpose of the PhD in research to kind of expand human knowledge? Mm-hmm. So that almost requires, it demands, you know, both critical thinking, problem solving, and innovativeness. Am I correct?
Yes, correct. I agree. I think of a PhD as a license to do research, as a way of formalizing your training and showing that you know enough to be able to go out there and do some research. I did want to add one other thought in terms of what makes a good PhD applicant. Certainly having publications helps, and many PhD applicants don't have any peer-reviewed journal articles, but getting your name on some abstracts and presenting at national meetings or even local meetings can be very meaningful and show that you are thinking in the publication zone.
Okay, great. Now, I think Flash kind of said that, you know, grades and test scores have declined in importance in the last 10 years. And you would agree with that. You're nodding your heads, Barry and Karen.
Yes. Yeah.
So, all right, let's turn this around a little bit. We've kind of been talking about what PhD programs would like to see in applicants. What should applicants be looking for when they're choosing a program? I think you have touched on this a little bit, but how important is the faculty advisor that one is going to work with? So, okay, Barry, go for it.
Well, having had a faculty advisor who was less than perfect, I can say that the lab is sort of a family, and you can have a dysfunctional family or a highly functional family. And so it's good to find out from the other grad students and other people working in the lab, postdocs, et cetera, just how healthy the psychological environment is in the lab. some advisors are negligent and don't pay attention. Some are really hands-on. Some are micromanagers. So understanding the psychological dynamics in the lab, I think, is one extremely important part of choosing correctly.
I also think the critical piece in looking for the right program is the research being conducted by the faculty in that department. And are there at least two faculty members that you could foresee yourself working with? Mm-hmm. And that should be the prime consideration of what schools you choose, rather than simply rankings.
Mm-hmm. Why two?
Well, at least two, because okay. One could be on sabbatical the fall that you arrive. And so then you have a backup. But yeah, at least two. And oftentimes, depending on how specific someone's research focus is, they will only find two.
Right.
I'll flip that around from the admissions committee perspective. It's a red flag if an applicant only wants to work with one faculty member, because mm-hmm. that faculty member can leave.
Right. You know,
or the student arrives and then they don't get along. And then the program is left with a big issue of like, well, how do we find a home for this student? And it's, you know, when it happens, it can be pretty traumatic. Mm-hmm. So they like somebody who, you know, has enough vision that they know people that whom they'd like to work with, but, you know, it's a group of them. So they're flexible.
It's not a monogamous relationship.
Right. Okay. Also, the way departments are organized today is they tend to form like research groups, because that allows them to apply for special grants for those kind of groups, and those are can be quite lucrative. So it behooves the department to grow these groups, you know, and have like 3 to 5 faculty members all working on a similar topic. Kind of environment makes for a nice research environment, because then there are other students and other labs related to yours, and they can teach you techniques, and you have journal clubs together. And so it can really improve beyond just the selection of your particular PI. You know, it expands your opportunities.
So. It makes sense. Great point. Now, we've kind of talked about a little bit and touched around, you know, the importance of research. If you can, getting published. If not getting published, then at least presenting. What is enough research? And I guess you've said that you don't have to be published, but sure is nice if you are. What if you're a second or third author? I mean, what are some of those factors? How do they play in? And Flash, you want to start this one?
I'd say it's significantly over 1,000 hours of undergraduate research.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, and then sometimes people will work in a lab or an industry for a year or two after grad school. So that really adds to their research total.
Oh, sure. Now, what should be the role of rankings in selecting schools? I think somebody said that they shouldn't play a role. Karen, do you want to start with that one?
Yeah, I didn't say they shouldn't play a role, but I think the prime consideration is the research in the department and the faculty that you would choose to work with. Certainly, you know, in terms of getting a good job in academia or industry, you know, the higher ranked the school, the better. However, there are many famous people in this country who came from state schools that aren't particularly ranked, and yet, you know, they become really one of the most charismatic leaders of industry. So I think it's a factor, but not one that you should dwell on.
Yeah, I would add that there are so many good PhD programs in the US. That's one of the things that's made us a really powerful country, is we have a huge research community. And it's sad to see a client apply to what they think are the top, you know, the top 5 schools and not get into any, because they're not applying broadly enough. There's so many opportunities out there, and it's less competitive at schools that are not supposedly high ranked, but still extremely competent and have really good researchers.
Yeah, when some of my clients say, you know, they're not sure what schools to apply to, I'll recommend thinking about the names that come up in the readings they've done as an undergrad. Mm-hmm. And look up where those faculty came from.
Sure, that's a great idea. Does it make a difference if an applicant sees their future in industry or in academia, or do research committees, PhD committees care in the STEM fields? Karen, you got this big smile on your face.
It will depend on your faculty advisor, but you know, okay, there are some faculty who are very biased toward academia and wanting to push you to stay in academia. So I think it's important, if you're not sure if you want industry or academia, that you find a mix of faculty in the department you're targeting that have done both and have, are at least consulting with industry as part of their research. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's in you as a person, whether you feel like you're an academic and want to teach and research, or you have this yearning to create something new in industry to help society.
Yeah. Anybody want to add, Barry or Flash?
Well, I picked up on the word teaching. That is an important part of applying. And in many programs, you, part of your pay is as a teaching assistant. And I think addressing your teaching skills or lack thereof in your personal statement is not a bad idea, especially if you're enthusiastic about teaching. I think that would be appreciated.
Okay, great. Great.
There was a time when industry was a bad word. And I think the vast majority of PhD students are going into industry.
So at this point, it's not quite as bad a word?
Not at all.
Okay. All right.
It's so hard to get into academia. Years ago, I heard the statistic that of the PhDs graduating from UCSF, 25% were able to get into academia. That leaves 75%, a large number of well-trained PhDs not getting into academia. So well, what Flash says is, makes total sense.
We have to keep in mind we're talking about STEM. If we were talking about English or history PhDs, we don't have as many choices to go into industry.
Sure.
Right, right. No, that's a whole different kettle of fish. But in STEM, there are lots of opportunities for PhDs in the STEM in this field. So it is different.
I think now, it would be good to talk about the SOP, because I know I have a lot of clients who apply, both domestic and internationally, but I think that there's a tendency to think that your grades, and if you take a test, your test and your work experience, what is going to get you into a school? And yet the essay is a critical component. And so I'd love to hear from Flash and from Barry, their thoughts on the SOP.
We're going to get to the SOP in a couple of minutes. So can we hold that for a second?
Absolutely.
And let's make sure we talk about international applicants, because that's a whole other genre.
Okay. I think those are both great suggestions. So what I wanted to ask next was, if I'm an undergrad and I intend to get a PhD, should I go for a master's first or try to get enough research as an undergrad and go straight for a PhD? What's the difference between going for the master's first or going directly into a PhD program?
I've been working with a number of clients recently who are in a position where it's like, should I go straight for a PhD or should I do the master's? It's really situation dependent, as well as field dependent. So some fields like neuroscience, there are no master's programs. And there are other fields such as, say, cell biology, stem cell sciences and stuff, where there are a lot of master's programs, but many of them are for pre-med students. So if you're interested in a PhD, you have to be able to find a program in your field which will allow you to work on, say, a research master's so that you can then use that as credentials to get the PhD. So
you have to make sure that the master's program requires some serious research.
Right. So, you know, the opportunities to take that path may be quite limited. And why would you take that path? It's for students who maybe discovered late in their undergraduate career that's like, oh, I really like research, but I haven't done enough to get into a PhD program. You know, maybe I only did 250 hours. So there are two paths you can take. One is to try to get into a lab, you know, working, starting out as a low-level tech and then work your way up. And, you know, those opportunities vary. And then the other is to get into a master's program where they offer the opportunity for a research master's degree. So typically a two-year master's, and that involves research, and that allows you to establish the credentials that you perhaps didn't develop as an undergraduate so that you can move on.
Great, thank
and
you.
And it can work, it can work.
I would add that in those master's programs that Flash is talking about, there's usually a thesis involved as well. And also from personal experience, people entering my graduate program, the one where I was a PhD student with a master's degree, were definitely ahead of me. I went straight from undergrad in terms of being prepared for the lab culture and also had obviously more research experience. So there is an advantage definitely to taking a master's program. It's not the fastest way, but it might be the gentlest way to get into a research lab.
Yeah, I'd say two things. Not everybody who gets into the master's program then decides to go on for the PhD. So, you know, having that mid-step sometimes is critical in your own career decision-making.
Yeah.
But I have had clients who've had a little research experience as an undergrad and they would like to apply directly to PhD, and I'll recommend to apply to both PhD programs and master's programs and see what happens.
That sounds like a great idea. And I think the point is very well taken that sometimes having an interim step can be a really, really useful move. What if someone did poorly in undergrad and let's say works for a few years, either in a lab or just in industry, and then they decide they want to return to school and pursue a PhD? They're more mature, whatever was going on in undergrad is no longer going on, or they've learned how to deal with it. Is it possible, or have those poor undergrad grades killed their chances? And Barry, you want to start with that one?
Sure. I don't think PhD programs worry about grades as much as, say, med schools and health profession schools. So they're pretty forgiving. Again, I think the main test is, do you show that you can think in your personal statement? Do you show that you can think in your interviews? I mean, having abysmal grades might be a red flag, but having, say, 3.0 or above science GPA probably would be pretty forgivable.
Okay. All right.
I think in that case, with low grades, the SOP becomes even more critical because you need to explain your story. You know,
right.
What have you done since then? And why are you seeking this PhD? And have you taken courses online?
You've done something to show you can handle it. Mm-hmm. Now,
I had a client who had pretty low undergraduate GPA, and I asked them to take this simple online test that tried to understand their learning style. And I thought they were a kinesthetic learner for sure, because they learned much more by doing than by sitting and listening or watching. And this person took this little test, and sure enough, they scored super high in kinesthetic and low in auditory and visual. And so we wove that into their personal statement, so that there's some rationale for them not doing well in lecture type courses. But those people, kinesthetic learners, tend to do really well in lab courses and as lab workers.
Fascinating. Great. All right. Thank you. Let's turn to the SOP, since you all seem to be chomping at the bit to address that. What is the role of the statement of purpose in PhD admissions? And Karen, why don't you start with that, since I think you really want to talk about it.
Yeah, I think it's a very critical piece of the entire application because, you know, a resume is facts, a list of facts, but it doesn't bring you alive. And the SOP, you have a chance to not only talk about your accomplishments, but you're talking about your goals. And it's a story, you know, that should make sense and should flow. And you also can talk a little bit about your values and motivations. And none of that is possible from a resume or even from letters of recommendation. You can get a little bit. But the SOP is where you have a chance to sell yourself and really show them who you are and where you're headed and why this program is the most important program for you because of what?
Okay. Barry, you want to?
That grabs it. I think writing an SOP that's multidimensional is good. In other words, it's only about why I want to go into research. Yeah, that's good, but it doesn't have a lot of personal information. It's good to give a little bit of background. Where are you coming from? What are your values? How much are you going to add to the cultural diversity of the program? Many schools now ask diversity questions. All the health.
Now that would be in addition to that statement of purpose, though, right?
It can be, but not necessarily.
Okay.
So if the school does not have a diversity, a DEI question, then make sure your personal statement at least has a paragraph on it.
Great tip.
I'd like to make a distinction between a personal statement and a statement of purpose.
Yeah. And
it used to be the grad programs would say, oh, just send us 5 pages about myself. Then that's evolved over time. And some graduate programs now actually have separate boxes for the personal statement and the statement of purpose. Personal statement is, who are you? You know, how did you get interested in science? And, you know, what drives you? And why do you even want a career in science? And then the statement of purpose is, okay, this is what I've done. This is why I did it. This is what I want to do next. And this is what I want to do with my life, right? So there's sort of two parts of the story, with the personal statement kind of being the more general earlier part, and the statement of purpose being the later part. And you can, you know, if they only ask for one, you can kind of combine the two, you know, go back to the old style. It depends on how much space you get and how specific their questions are. But I think in general, it pays to give a little bit of that sort of motivational background as part of your story. But then I totally agree with what Karen was saying about, you know, explaining your path, you know, make sense of your life.
Goals.
Right. Yeah. And where are you going and why are you doing that?
Yeah. You're using a key word, why.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, the resume doesn't tell why, but your SOP should absolutely be the whys of every decision you've made. Mm-hmm.
And intend to make. And there's why this program, why this program, how does this program, or why does this program support your post PhD goals?
And then you have unique experiences. Like what you mentioned, one of you mentioned funding and the importance of, you know, gaining funding. One of my clients was able to gain funding in a master's program and mentioned that in the SOP. And I thought that was great. Because if you were, you know, if you were able to do that, then you'll be able to do it in the future. So not everybody has that kind of opportunity, but what other opportunities have you had? You know, you want to, as you always say, Linda, you want to fit in and stand out.
Right. Right. The other thing, I once had a friend's daughter, really, really close friend. I've known the girl at the time, young woman now, since infancy. And she wanted help with her statement of purpose. So I looked it over and I said, well, what do you want to do with the degree? Because I didn't know after reading her statement of purpose. And she says, I don't know. Well, how do you intend to write a statement of purpose without having a purpose for your studies? It's pretty difficult. It's actually impossible because there is no purpose. So what is the purpose? I mean, you have to answer that question, I think, also. The purpose of applying to this program, the purpose of pursuing the course of study, period. I think those are topics that have to be addressed in the statement of purpose. And one of the distinctions I make, I don't know if you folks would agree with me, is that the statement of purpose is a more forward-looking document than the personal statement. The personal statement is pretty much more how you got to this point, what were the key motivations, key events, et cetera, and most influential experiences. The statement of purpose, yes, it should deal with your motivations for pursuing the purpose you have in mind, but it's a more future-oriented document.
The goals are really important because, you know, some of my clients come up with a very, very narrow goal. And I'll keep pushing them to think about it more globally, because I think these programs, you know, would like to see that their alumni are doing something worthwhile for the world. And so somehow in your SOP, you know, push yourself to think harder.
What's the benefit of whatever you wanted to achieve to society? Now, somebody mentioned funding a few minutes ago. What is the role of funding in the application process, or does it come more once you're accepted?
Well, many STEM programs have federal funding. Which again, tremendously helps the country build up a huge research community. I went to grad school, my tuition was covered and I got a small stipend. But if you go to a PhD program in English, I think it's very unlikely you would have that kind of support. Now, that's fine for US citizens and maybe green card holders. But if you're an international applicant, you have a whole other situation where you're competing against dozens of other international applicants, maybe for one spot that the department is willing to fund themselves, or for many international applicants, there's a place in the application where it says, where's the money that you're going to use for your tuition and living expenses and get ready to put it in an escrow account.
Oh, wow.
So that's a very different situation for international applicants.
What are some of the other distinctions for international applicants?
I mean, I would say command of English, ability to express oneself coherently, slowly, articulating carefully.
Anybody else want to comment on it? Flash, what were you about to say?
If the university research that you've been involved with is very different from the American system, it can be difficult for the admissions committee to evaluate. Mm-hmm. So I think the easiest ones are where somebody has worked in a lab, say in Japan, that's collaborated with one of the faculty in the program that you're applying to, and that faculty member did a sabbatical in that lab, you know, so that there's a connection and they understand what the student did and why it was significant and applicable to the program that they're applying to. In the absence of that, it becomes very difficult. It's like, okay, what did you really do? And, you know, like you were saying originally, Linda, like, were you slave laborer in that lab? we just don't know. And then oftentimes it's difficult to interpret other grading systems. You know, or even the contents of particular courses. So,
on the other hand, some of my best academically and experience-wise applicants have been international, and they bring to the table a diversity that adds to the department and to their peers. So I would not discourage international students from applying. You know, they absolutely can make a program more diverse and more interesting.
And they also bring their own experiences, both in the lab, outside the lab, to whatever program they join. Mm-hmm. Right.
Labs are surprisingly multicultural and international. It's wonderful to walk into a lab and see people from four or five different countries working together.
Right. Who should applicants seek as recommenders? Flash, you want to start with this one?
Definitely the undergraduate research PI. If that letter is absent, that's a red flag.
What if it came from a master's program? And their master's advisor?
Yeah, hopefully the same thing, that it's somebody that they did research with in the master's program, because that's what the admissions committee wants to know. They want to know, what are your credentials for working in my lab? Yeah.
Makes sense.
And I've had good applicants who had research experience in industry and were able to use their industry supervisor, who often had a PhD.
Right. It's good to get an academic letter. Oftentimes you're limited to two or three letters. With three letters, I would definitely include an academic letter from somebody who actually had you in more than one course and can speak to your intellectual talents.
Thinking ability. You were focusing on ability to think a little while ago, right?
Yes, exactly.
Any advice for interview prep? I mean, most PhD candidates are interviewed. I actually heard a story. When my son graduated high school, there was an award given out by a certain woman in memory of her mother, who was in the STEM fields in the 50s and 60s. She had a PhD. And one day she was about to interview a PhD candidate. She was standing at a file cabinet, putting something in the file cabinet. She happened to be obviously pregnant. The PhD candidate walked into her office, saw her standing, a young woman pregnant, standing at the file cabinet, and said, "Could you get me a cup of coffee, please?"
Oh,
and she said, "Sure, no problem." She went and got two cups of coffee, one for herself, one for him, gave him the cup of coffee and went around the desk and sat down and said, "Hello, I'm Dr. So-and-so. Let's start the interview." Okay. But other than assuming that a female that you see, you know, is not the person going to interview you, what advice would you have for interview prep?
You know, most interviews today are not in person.
That's true. That's true.
They're online.
They wouldn't have that opportunity.
And the advice I give to my clients is, for most PhD interviews, from what my clients have told me, it really is a conversation. And it's not a grilling, because by that point, they have a lot of information on you. And if they want an interview, it pretty much means they're just trying to make sure you're the right fit for their program. And the most important questions to be able to respond to is, what draws you to this program? What are you going to contribute to our team? And really critical is, what questions do you have for them?
So prepare some questions.
Mm-hmm. And be a good listener.
That's always great advice, Barry. In all kinds of situations, that's great advice.
That good listening comes to the SOP too, because you need to read the question, listen to the question, answer the question.
Right. I actually thought to mention that and forgot. So I'm really glad you mentioned it, Karen, that it really, the prompts count.
Yes.
And the other prompts, if you have short answer questions alongside the main SOP question, that also counts.
I just had a client who sent me his essay. It had no connection to the prompts.
Oh, gosh.
None.
Wow.
So with Barry's good listening, I think that also connects to asking good questions.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the most effective PhD interview is when you're listening to somebody and you can ask good questions about their research.
Yes.
And that's not something you can prepare. It's on the spot. So.
Right. Well, it would also be advisable, if you know who's interviewing you, maybe to read some of the recent research, right, wouldn't it?
Yes, definitely.
Right.
And practice, practice, practice. You build confidence and then you're less nervous and you can find your mistakes and correct them. If you don't practice, then you're on more unfirm ground.
Absolutely. You want to have a dress rehearsal where you can make mistakes without an audience present.
Several.
Right. Absolutely.
I always suggest to smile and laugh where appropriate, because they want to like you in the lab. And don't be overly serious. It's just as much your interview as their interview. You need to find out whether you feel comfortable in this lab and with this faculty member.
This may seem obvious, but some of the interviews are really long. They last all day. There's a bunch of group presentations, etc. Do not turn off your camera. This again seems obvious, but it's not, doesn't look good if your camera's off. And some folks are used to keeping their camera off in Zoom lectures, which is hard on the instructor. But in an interview, it really reflects badly on you to not have your camera on.
My son once had an interview where the interviewers turned their camera off. They wanted his camera on and their interviewers off. And he completed the interview, but there was a headhunter involved. And he just said, "I don't want to work for that firm." Any suggestions for reapplicants other than this time around, get an accepted consultant, one of you folks to assist you. In addition to that, what would you recommend for reapplicants? Barry, you want to start with that one?
Sure. Well, in the intervening year or two, get more research experience, have more publications, even presentations at meetings. Identify what the weak parts were in your application and address them. If it's an interview, if you got to the interview stage, then you might really work hard on your interviewing skills.
So I completely agree with that. I think the other thing you can do is to think about which schools are the best fit for you. Because it may be that you apply to, you know, top name programs or something, but it turns out that they're not actually the top name in your field, or they're not really appropriate for you. So make sure you get the right fit.
Great point.
Totally agree. Yes.
Karen, you have anything to add to that?
Nope, they said it all.
All right. What do you wish I would have asked you? And you can each have a different question for that one. Okay. Flash, you want to start with that? What do you wish? What would you like to say at this point in terms of advice to PhD?
You asked all kinds of great questions.
Thank you.
Mine's not really an answer to a question, but something I wanted to add from a previous conversation here, which is that things are starting to loosen up in terms of in-person interviews. So I'm having more and more clients right now flying in for in-person interviews.
Really?
Yeah. And I think that it's a good thing. It allows you as an applicant to better appreciate the program. It allows the faculty to say, oh, come visit my lab, meet my people, right? You know, it's not something that's easy to accomplish on Zoom. And I think it works on both ends. It makes a better evaluation of you, and you can evaluate them better.
I think that's a really good point. And some of my clients have gone to the university on their own and actually met with graduate admissions office staff and gotten to know them and, you know, been able to talk to some students and sometimes even faculty. And then you have that much more to write in your SOP.
Good point. Do you recommend that if a student is particularly interested in a program and it's not too difficult to get to the program, that they just go and visit the lab, the program, talk to people?
Absolutely.
Even if there is a Zoom interview?
Yeah, because you gain information from talking to graduate students who are in the program.
Right. Barry, what would you like to?
Well, I did ask my question, which was, what about international students? And I think we covered that. So I feel very happy about that.
Okay. So you're a happy camper here. All right. Karen, what do you wish I would have asked you today? Or what would you like to say just as a closing comment?
I think, you know, applying to graduate school, like everything else with your career, it's an exploration. And try not to have set ideas up front. Keep your mind open to opportunities that present themselves along the way and research as much as you can before you start applying, because you might be surprised at what you uncover.
Okay, great.
I'd like to add to that.
Sure, go ahead.
I tell my clients, both the ones applying to health profession schools and PhD programs, the application process is transformative. It's not just writing an English 101 essay. It's taking stock of your life, seeing where you're at and where you want to go. And you often discover things about yourself that you didn't have time to think about while you were on the 4-year conveyor belt of undergraduate school.
Right. True. All too true.
Yeah. And sometimes I'll say, you know, in talking with a client, we'll conclude that they're better off waiting a year.
Yeah.
They're not ready. And they need to gather more information before they can really make a competitive application.
Either need to gather more information or have more experience or improve some aspect of their qualifications. Barry, I've quoted you many times in the context of medical school admissions, but I think it holds here too.
Right.
Sometimes the fastest way is slowly.
Right. Right? I don't say sometimes.
Okay. All right.
Right.
Sounds good. Well, Karen Flashberry, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. I think this has been a great discussion. Listener, if you would like to learn more about Dr. Karen Ash, Dr. Herman Gordon, or Dr. Barry Rothman, or take advantage of their expertise in STEM PhD admissions and career advising, we're going to include links to their bios and contact me pages in the show notes at accepted.com/566. Again, you can learn more at accepted.com/566 and just take a beeline to talk with any of our highly respected guests today. Listener, thank you too for joining today's panel and me for our 566th episode. If you find the show worthwhile, I have a suggestion for you. Subscribe. That way you won't miss any of our future shows, whether with admissions directors, writing experts, test prep pros, fantastic admissions consultants, or alumni doing great things. You can find subscribe links in the show notes at, you guessed it, accepted.com/566. A quick reminder, Master the Paradox of STEM PhD Admissions, by downloading our free guide, Fitting In and Standing Out, which I think Barry referred to earlier. That's Karen, the paradox. Karen did. Okay. The paradox at the heart of admissions. You can grab your copy. Again, it's free at accepted.com/FISO. Thanks again for coming. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.